Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 1st of October. Our main stories: Congress orders Donald Trump's lawyer to hand over documents related to the impeachment investigation. Police in Hong Kong are braced for further violence as China celebrates 70 years of communist rule. And a controversial change in health advice as scientists say we can carry on eating red meat. Also in this podcast:
Durme, durme, mi angelico, hijico chico de tu nacido.
Their ancestors were forced into exile more than 500 years ago. Now, Jews with roots in Spain are being welcomed back. The revelations about the Trump administration's controversial dealings with foreign governments are coming thick and fast. Australia has now confirmed that the US president asked the Australian Prime Minister to help investigate Robert Mueller's Russia inquiry, with the US Attorney General involved. At the same time, Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has been ordered to hand over documents relevant to the impeachment inquiry into the president's now infamous phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. Mr. Trump himself has lashed out at the congressman leading the inquiry, accusing him of fabricating a transcript of the call.
Adam Schiff made up what I said. He actually took words and made it up. The reason is when he saw my call, it was so good that he couldn't quote from it because there was nothing done wrong. So Adam Schiff made up a phony call, and he read it to Congress and he read it to the people of the United States. And it's a disgrace.
I got the latest from our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
What we can make of this is that things are moving extremely fast, and there's a lot happening this week. The latest news, as we've just been hearing, is that Rudy Giuliani has received a subpoena to hand over documents, copies of text messages and other relevant material, email relating to his connections with what's been happening, and specifically the involvement that he's had with Ukrainian officials. It seems to ask for help to investigate Joe Biden, the former vice president, who could well be President Trump's opponent at the next election. And at this stage, he has been asked simply for documents. He's been given until the middle of October. It is quite possible that he could be subpoenaed to appear before a congressional committee at some point in the future.
And this is where the ramifications of having an impeachment inquiry become clear, because they can ask for documents, they can ask for witnesses, and it appears President Trump is not happy.
President Trump is very unhappy, and we've seen that through, I think, more than 100 tweets or retweets over the weekend venting over this. He has said that he wants to meet his accuser. He wants to know the identity of the whistleblower. He also wants to know who the person is that gave the whistleblower the information that that person based his allegations on. He is venting his fury at Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, saying that he's been acting in a treasonous way. And this is related to the account that Adam Schiff gave of what Donald Trump said in that now famous telephone call to the president of Ukraine. Adam Schiff was parodying. It was a parody. He was using his own words to describe what he felt that Mr. Trump had said. He was relaying the essence of what Donald Trump had said. But this has angered the president because it wasn't verbatim. It certainly really didn't bear too much relation in terms of a close copy of what the transcript of the conversation that he had with the Ukrainian president said. So he was taking, through the eyes of some, a little bit of a liberty.
It's all very complicated, lots of Ukrainian names that people might find hard to keep track of. Is this cutting through to the US public?
It seems that it is. Up until the last couple of days, if you ask people across the country whether they want to see the president impeached or indeed an impeachment inquiry, only a minority would say yes to that question. Now it is inching towards a majority, just over 50% of people in some opinion polls carried out in the last few days believe that this impeachment investigation, this inquiry, is the right thing to do. So it does seem to be getting through to people, whereas previously, look at the Mueller investigation, once all of that was over, people didn't believe that the president ought to be impeached after various allegations came out about his behaviour during that time.
Peter Bowes. The authorities in Hong Kong are braced for what they describe as very dangerous unrest on the streets when China marks the 70th anniversary of the start of communist rule. Police say they've received credible intelligence that protesters are planning a major escalation after a weekend of clashes with officers. Activists have been denied permission to hold a legal rally today. Nearly 2,000 kilometres away in Beijing, meanwhile, the anniversary will be marked with a huge display of pageantry and military might. It's another sign of the widening divide between the former British colony and mainland China, as Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports.
Today on Tiananmen Square in Beijing, the whole of China's Communist Party leadership turned out to remember the millions who died in the long struggle to establish what they call New China. Dressed in dark suits, President Xi and the other Politburo members bowed in front of the monument to the people's heroes. This was the moment of victory. 70 years ago, when Chairman Mao stood atop the Gate of Heavenly Peace and declared, China has stood up. The country he took over was dirt poor, ravaged by a century of almost continuous conflict. Standing on a hilltop in Hong Kong today, looking across into mainland China, that same country is unrecognisable.
When I first crossed over from Hong Kong into China down there 30 years ago, on the other side, Shenzhen was just a dusty little border town. Now it is a gleaming city of 12 million people. China's transformation has been astonishing, and its people are rightly proud of their achievement. But outside of the mainland, China's new wealth and power is causing deep unease, even fear, and nowhere more so than here in Hong Kong.
For 4 months, the streets of Hong Kong have boiled with rage. The young protesters who've taken to the streets week after week do not trust the Chinese Communist Party or its paramount leader Xi Jinping.
A lot of what's going on here in Hong Kong now seems deliberately designed to provoke the central government in Beijing. For example, I'm in a pedestrian underpass here now, one of the main ones that leads from the Old Star Ferry into central Hong Kong. And on the floor here, the protesters have pasted dozens of pictures of President Xi Jinping's face, deliberately so that people walking through here will have to walk right across his face as they do so.
So many people, they don't like Communist Party, but
in their small flat on the south side of Hong Kong Island, David and his mother Anne sit on opposite sides of this increasingly bitter divide. David is typical of many educated young Hong Kongers.
We all always say that 50 years, no changes, and until the 20 or 47. But we find that the days of 2047 has come now.
They have 200 years to build a better USA. But China only got 70 years. If better China, then we better Hong Kong. Better China, better Hong Kong.
David is among the young protesters who've now begun waving American flags and demanding the United States impose sanctions on China.
Why are the people supporting America in the trade war? Because we want the Chinese Communist Party has fallen apart because of that.
Such talk makes Hong Kong's small but noisy band of super patriots extremely angry. In a park this morning, a group of about 50 gathered, waving bright red Chinese flags and singing patriotic songs. Their leader, Po Chun-chung, says those who fear communist China have been brainwashed by their former British colonial masters.
Hong Kong was ruled by Britain for over 150 years. They did not teach us respect for our Chinese roots, but encouraged us to have anti-China and anti-communist beliefs.
On Tuesday, China's most powerful leader since Mao will review a military now second in strength only to the United States. It is a sight that will make many Chinese hearts swell with pride. But its neighbours look on with growing concern about how China will use its newfound power.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting. If you thought the debate over eating red meat was settled, it's bad for the environment and bad for you, think again. The latter statement at least has been challenged by a group of researchers. They say people can continue to eat red meat because they say there's little evidence of an increase in the risk of cancer and heart disease. However, the findings are controversial and public health experts say they risk undermining sensible eating advice. Here's our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh.
Current guidance is that people should eat no more than 70 grams of red or processed meat a day, equivalent to two rashers of bacon or 1.5 pork sausages. This is because of multiple studies over many years linking the products to an increased bowel cancer risk. Now, a team of international experts has reviewed the data and has found that the evidence of increased risk, although there, is weak, and that it isn't worth most people changing their eating habits. Using the same data, most public health bodies worldwide have come to a very different conclusion. How can this be? Well, cutting back on the amount of bacon or burgers you eat may make very little difference to your individual risk of getting bowel cancer. But across a whole population, it could mean preventing thousands of cases every year. This latest study did not look at the environmental impact of producing red and processed meat, or at animal welfare.
Fergus Walsh. Imagine going for a job, acing the test, and then being rejected. Well, it does happen, of course, but South Korean women applying for work on the Seoul subway found that no matter how well they did, they had no chance of being hired. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me why.
South Korea's auditor has found that back in 2016, six women applied to work for Seoul's subway system. They were applying to work as engineers, as drivers, as workers there. And they had to write a written test, like all applicants, but none of them were hired. The auditor then found out that the subway system hiring managers had manipulated the test results so that the women appeared to have failed the test that they wrote, when in fact, they'd all done relatively well. In fact, one woman surpassed all of the applicants, including the men.
But still didn't get the job. Do we know why the managers did this?
Well, the auditors say that the managers were worried that the women wouldn't be tough enough to do the job. And they also cited the fact that there were no accommodations for the women. The subway system has since come back to defend themselves by saying they were also concerned that the women wouldn't have the physical attributes to do the job. However, that seems a little bit suspect because they had to pass a written test. So why put that in place if you then have to falsely manipulate the results? Why not just put a physical test in place if that really is a concern?
And how common is this kind of problem in South Korea?
Well, it's commonly said that South Korea has the thickest glass ceiling in the world. So among developed countries, women in South Korea have the highest rate of education, yet they have one of the lowest rates of employment. So there does seem to be a huge gap, a big problem for women to actually get higher. They also have one of the world's largest gender pay gaps. We've also seen in South Korea in recent years this same story that I've just told you about problems in hiring in the Seoul subway system told over and over again. So the three largest banks in South Korea have found to manipulate interview results and the exam results of female applicants so that they don't get hired. We've also seen one CEO, former head of the Korean Gas Safety Corporation, was actually sentenced to 4 years in prison and slapped with quite a hefty fine after he stopped women from being hired at his company because he said he was worried that they would simply go on maternity leave. And so he put a rule in place not to hire women.
Celia Hatton. Now to a country trying to right a historic wrong.
Durme, durme, mi angelico, y chico chico de tu nación, criatura de Sion.
The doleful sound of Ladino music, the traditional language of the Sephardi Jews, descendants of Jewish people expelled from Spain and Portugal in the late 15th century. In 2015, in order to compensate for the shameful events of the past, Spain announced it would offer Spanish citizenship to the Sephardi. Applications closed on Monday. So how many people applied? I spoke to our reporter in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco.
We know that over 100,000 people have registered for this scheme. What the government has said is that until the end of August, around 60,000 Jews had registered to try and get Spanish nationality. And then suddenly throughout September, I suppose, as the deadline loomed, many of them realised that they didn't have much time left. So another 50,000 have tried to apply over the last few weeks alone. So overall, more than 100,000.
And what do they have to prove to be able to get this citizenship?
They do have to come to Spain. So that may be a hurdle for many people who would be interested in this. They have to appear before a notary in Spain with documents that can prove that they have some kind of Sephardic ancestry. So they might get a certificate, for example, from a Jewish association here in Spain. There are other things as well that they can use in their favour. Their surname might be at least partly proof of their ancestry. They also may need to prove that they have some kind of knowledge of the Spanish language. They would have to take a basic Spanish exam, as migrants tend to have to do coming to Spain anyway. And all of that has to be formalised by a notary here in Spain.
Now, we all know how divisive an issue migration is in parts of Europe. How has this scheme gone down in Spain?
Well, it hasn't really caused much of turmoil in Spain. I mean, when it was announced, it was, for the most part, it was welcomed. I think the feeling was that it was a scheme that wasn't going to get a huge number of applicants anyway. The feeling was also that it was kind of a win-win situation for the Spanish government at the time, which announced this. It was a Conservative government of Mariano Rajoy. There was not really any cost involved. Many of these people who were coming may have had links with Spain already, or were people who were perhaps coming from former colonies of Spain, countries in Latin America which have close links to the country. So in the big scheme of things, this was not going to be a huge problem, and there really hasn't been very much political resistance to it.
And why, 500 years on, did they feel that they wanted to reach out to these people?
Some people at the time that this was announced back in 2015 said that the Conservative government at the time in Spain was trying to somehow appease Israel, because Spain had voted a couple of years earlier against Israel and in favour of Palestine in a UN vote. I should point out that the Spanish government then said this was nothing to do with that UN vote, and instead that this was simply a way of atoning for a 500-year-old injustice, that this was an instance of a country treating a people extremely badly, albeit 500 years ago, and something needs to be done about it. And this was a relatively easy way of atoning.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. The BBC has been forced into an embarrassing climb down after a race row over comments made by a presenter about President Trump. Last week, Naga Manchetti, who presents in the mornings on the main BBC TV channel, was reprimanded for breaching impartiality rules when she discussed Mr. Trump's motives for racist remarks about four congresswomen of colour. There was quite a backlash over the reprimand, and a few hours ago, the BBC boss, Tony Hall, said he was overturning the decision to uphold a complaint against the presenter. Our entertainment correspondent, Lisa Mazimba, is following the story.
End of last week, the BBC was adamant that what Naga Manchetti had said with her comments about President Trump's motivation behind what was a racist tweet was not something she should have done on BBC Breakfast. And that was the decision of the very high-powered executive complaints unit here, and backed up by the editorial policy unit here at the BBC. Now, of course, since the decision was made, there's been a lot of comments, both by the public, from social media, and from many of Naga Manchetti's broadcasting colleagues, not just at the BBC, but across the industry, culminating in an open letter to a newspaper. Lord Hall, the Director General, was asked to look at this decision again. This evening he announced that he'd done exactly that and decided that even though this was a finely balanced judgment, the Executive Complaints Unit got it wrong and that Nag Aman Chetty hadn't done anything wrong. So it's a complete reversal of the BBC's strongly entrenched position from last week. Lord Hall, I think, with this statement, is trying to draw a line and saying, this is my final decision. Hopefully this will make lots of people, including Nag Aman Chetty, happy. But there will be others looking, quite rightly, you say, at the process of how the BBC gets there, and just perhaps another instance of a small crisis erupting within the BBC that the BBC hasn't dealt with as cleanly as people sometimes expect.
Lizo Mazimba. And still to come on the podcast.
Behold the swirling drama of the merciless seas, routes and rivers upon which our dark fortunes were traded.
The new centrepiece installation at the Tate Modern in London, which challenges colonialism. More than 100 people have died in northeast India after torrential monsoon rains caused severe flooding in Uttar Pradesh and Bihar states. The rains in India this year have continued for longer than expected. They're 10% above average and the highest in 25 years, with climate change being blamed. Thousands of people have been moved to relief camps. Patients and their relatives have been seen sitting on beds in flooded hospitals in Bihar's main city, Patna. Dilnawaz Pasha from BBC Hindi is there.
I was in one of the worst affected localities in Patna, that is Rajendra Nagar. The streets are still waterlogged. There are several hundred people who are still trapped in their own houses waiting for relief and rescue. One of the things which I noticed today is that, you know, the number of rescue boats which are deployed is far less than the actual requirement. The relatives, they were shouting at the authorities. I mean, the roads, they are completely waterlogged. People can't move. Neither the public nor the government was prepared for this scenario, because in this particular season, the rains are not that, you know, this much. Everybody I spoke to, they were saying that, you know, there is changing pattern in the climate, and everybody was angry at the response of the government. Maybe because, you know, it's 5 days, they don't have food to eat, they don't have clean water. And I spoke to, you know, several girls who were rescued from their hostel. They say that they have to live without food for like 2 days.
Dilnawaz Pasha in Patna. One part of the world that's most vulnerable to climate change is Vietnam, where global warming is having a huge impact on the Mekong Delta. The southwestern agricultural heartland is home to around 19 million people, a fifth of Vietnam's population. Ashley Jean-Baptiste went to meet some families there.
With rising sea levels, coastal erosion and saltwater intrusion destroying farming land, climate change is a reality here in Vietnam. Families across the Mekong Delta are facing an increasingly desperate situation. We met Nguyen Van Lung and his wife Pham in Sok Trang, a coastal province that has been particularly impacted by erosion. Last summer, in the middle of the night, two buildings on their property collapsed. Around the corner from where the main house used to be, the couple have built a temporary shelter out of corrugated iron sheets with waterproof tarpaulin covering their belongings. They fear the rest of their property is at risk.
We haven't had a sound night's sleep since our houses collapsed. We may move far away from this area. It's scary to live on the riverbank.
18 million people currently live in the Mekong Delta. But according to Vietnamese government statistics, 1.3 million people left the Delta region in the last 10 years. Less than 300,000 arrived. A study at Van Lang University in Vietnam found that 15% of those leaving moved because of climate change, but this number could be far higher. Increasingly, families who feel unable to cope with the changes are choosing to leave the Delta in an attempt to find more stability in cities like Ho Chi Minh or Canto. Some move as part of a government program designed to help vulnerable families relocate. Others move independently, like this couple, Nguyen Tan Mok and his wife, Lee Thi Ngoc Lan.
Many years ago, we lived happily in our hometown. We could make our living through agriculture. Later, it was more difficult to farm due to the salt water and acidic soil. We lost our crops. For that reason, we moved to the city to start this bike washing business.
But this isn't an option for everyone. More than three quarters of people in the Mekong Delta work in agriculture, so their livelihoods are intrinsically linked to environmental changes. It's creating an impossible situation for some. We met with some local farmers.
We can now only harvest two crops instead of three each year, and the success of these is not a sure thing. To counteract this risk, we have to work as labourers or breed our cattle to make extra income.
Have you thought about moving to the city because of the impacts of climate change?
We won't leave our hometown.
I don't think I would move to live in the city because I'm used to the farming life. It would be hard for a farmer like me to find a job in the city.
What happens here in Vietnam isn't unique. The World Bank estimates that over 140 million people could be internally displaced by 2050 because of climate change. Other countries will have to deal with environmental displacement. Vietnam is both a warning and an example of how the world will have to adapt and change.
That report by Ashley John-Baptiste is part of a BBC series called The Displaced, which explores global migration and how it's changing our world. More details on the BBC website. Leading athletes have criticised poor attendances for marring showpiece events at the World Championships in Doha. Just over 13,000 people watched the opening session on Friday, and attendances have fallen since then, leaving big gaps in a stadium that can hold 40,000. Organisers have blamed a range of factors, including TV schedules and the start of the working week in Qatar. With more, here's our sports correspondent, Natalie Perks.
It's going to be Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce coming away. It's going to be her fourth gold medal.
It was a huge moment in women's sprinting. But as Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce and silver medal winner Dina Asher-Smith began their laps of honour at around 11:30pm local time, there were barely any fans left in the Khalifa Stadium. It's led to questions about why Doha was chosen as a venue. Here's the heptathlon Olympic champion Denise Lewis.
I think the athletes have been let down massively. To watch Dina Asher-Smith walking around her celebratory lap with not a soul in sight was heartbreaking.
When Doha first bid for these championships, it made the bold promise that having no empty seats was very achievable. But for the last 2 years, Qatar has been the subject of a political blockade from four neighbouring countries, which has made travel here difficult. The local organisers admit crowd numbers have been below their expectations, but they stressed their ambition for the first World Championships in the Middle East to welcome the world and connect to new fans remained undimmed. With a World Cup in Qatar 3 years away, football's governing body, FIFA, will be watching with interest.
Natalie Perks. If you're using an app or website with text on the screen, Unicode is almost certainly working in the background. Today, Myanmar is set to become the last country to adopt the coding system. I heard more about Unicode from our reporter, Anna Aslam.
So it's basically the way everything on the internet is coded. So any coding system takes a character, it assigns a numerical value, and then that's how the computer sort of stores the data, processes it, all of that. What makes Unicode special is that it works across all platforms and devices and languages. So if I was to open an article on Wikipedia in English here in London on my iPhone, and my parents opened the same article in Pakistan in Urdu on their Samsung, we should be able to get the same information.
Because of Unicode, but Myanmar wasn't using it. Why not? And what were they using instead?
No, it kind of gained popularity in the 90s when the internet became a much bigger thing and Microsoft and Apple really pushed it to become the global standard. At the time, Myanmar's former junta had sort of isolated the country, so it basically got left out, which means a lot of international content and even content from within their own country shows up as just meaningless symbols that they can't read.
So what will people in Myanmar notice when Unicode does come in?
So right now what they have is they develop their own code called Zoji, which works and most people use it, but it can only be used in Myanmar. It can only be used in Burmese, which a third of the population doesn't speak as a first language, and it can only be used on specific devices. So the idea is the switch has sort of been advocated for many years. It'll be a bit chaotic in the transition period, but what it means is they'll be able to sort of access a lot more information from international outlets, and tech experts say that it'll put Myanmar in line with sort of the rest of the digital world.
Anna Aslam. Since it opened in the year 2000, the huge Turbine Hall at the Tate Modern Art Gallery here in London has been the temporary home of a range of exhibits, both big and small. The installations have included a giant crack, helter skelters, and more than 100 million porcelain sunflower seeds. This week, the American artist Kara Walker gives her perspective on the British Empire with a monumental creation, as our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd reports.
Kara Walker was in London when she stumbled across a huge fountain. She immediately loved the Victoria Memorial outside Buckingham Palace. Now she's created her own version, more than 40 feet tall, in the Tate Turbine Hall, questioning and satirising its imperial bombast.
Behold the swirling drama of the merciless seas, routes and rivers, upon which our dark fortunes were traded. Come, one and all, to marvel and contemplate the monumental misrememberings of colonial exploits yon.
Kara Walker found acclaim reviving the genteel art of paper silhouettes while making incisive points about America and the slave trade. The Tate Modern Fountain is beautiful, but it contains sharks rather than dolphins and figures struggling in the water.
And it's really, I think, about power more than it is about the nation or place, and about the ways that power has been unequally distributed and how the imposition of race, for instance, determines the fates of peoples.
The statue, titled Fons Americanus, is one of Tate Modern's most attractive and thought-provoking Turbine Hall installations. It's there until April next year.
Vincent Dowd. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.